Okay, congratulations. I think you did well on the exam. I don't see the TAs here yet, but I presume they have your exams. If you haven't gotten it back yet, it'll be here. Okay. So you may want to know what's coming for next exam. So we've been talking about atoms, and we got to a cul-de-sac last Wednesday when we found out that orbitals can't work from any electron atoms. So today we'll talk about how you can recover from that and still use orbitals. And then we'll go on to talk about molecules. Now, the main tool we'll use about talking with molecules is not this. First, we'll talk about plum pudding molecules and the United Atom Limit. And then we'll talk about how to understand bonds in terms of pairwise linear combinations of atomic orbitals. That's our main goal. But first, I want to talk about these plum pudding molecules. And energy match and overlap is going to be the key to understanding, as you'll see. Then we'll go on to reality, the structure and dynamics of XH3 molecules, show you some real experimental results and how our understanding stacks up against reality. And then we'll go on to reactivity and highest occupied molecular orbitals and lowest unoccupied molecular orbitals, which is sort of the main tool we use to recognize what functional groups are going to be. And that, of course, is the payoff for organic chemistry, is to be able to look at a molecule that you've never seen before and know how it will react. And then, after we've done all this stuff with theory, we'll go back and see how organic chemistry really happened. It didn't start with Schrödinger's equation. Okay, so at the end last time we were talking about how to handle more than one electron. We're really masters of one electron atoms. We got the exact solutions for them. It's only a question of how to convey what we understand. But if you have two electrons, then it's a function of six variables. Wouldn't it be neat if we could write it as a product of functions of one electron each, and then we could just multiply them together, multiply the probabilities to get the joint probability, but it can't work, as we said last time, because electrons repel one another, so that's out. So that means orbitals won't work, so this paradise that we were looking for vanished. But there are tricks to be able to use orbitals anyhow, despite the fact that fundamentally they can't work. The first trick is called Z-effective. So what you do is pretend, for purposes of understanding an orbital, a one-electron wave function within a many-electron atom or molecule, you pretend that all the other electrons, all they do is make the nuclear charge less effective. Right? Obviously, an electron coming to a C plus 6 nucleus is different from an electron coming from a C plus 6 nucleus that also has five other electrons on it. It's obviously different from Coulomb's law. But suppose you could just sort of pretend that all these other five electrons are just effectively reducing the charge of the carbon, so it becomes like a hydrogen atom, right? Just plus one, right? And then you would know how this thing behaved if that were true, which of course it's not. But this is a crude first approximation. So what charge should you use for the nucleus? Well, remember we have the formula for a 1s orbital, which depends on rho. But rho, remember, was scaled according to what the nuclear charge is. So all you have to do is plug in a different z, a lower nuclear charge, and you have at some level taken into a fact there that there's repulsion as well as attraction going on. Is that clear enough what the goal is? Okay. So the question is, what should you use for Z effective? And two people that were at IBM in 1963 tried to figure out what the best value was to use for the effective Z in order to fit the energies that you got if you used a much better theory to do the real thing. So 1963, about 46 years ago, IBM was the place where they had big computers. So they used an IBM 7090 and cranked away on it, which would be about as effective as I don't know, 1% of my laptop now. But they got better values. I'll mention shortly how they got better values. And then tried to match the energies they got there by adjusting Z. Okay? So what Z should you use? Well, for a helium atom, which had two electrons, what should Z be, actually? Should be 2, right? The nuclear charge of helium is 2. But if the other electron is there, it's going to a little bit screen the nucleus. Right, so it's as if the nuclear charge weren't quite so big. Now, what value should you use? If it was completely screening the nucleus, if the other electron was right down on the nucleus and stayed there, which of course it can't do, because it would have such high kinetic energy. But if it did that, then the effective nuclear charge would be 1 instead of 2. But the best value that they found, Clementi and Raimondi, was 1.69, right? So it just reduces it by about 0.3, the existence of this other electron. And then you get a pretty good approximation for what the electron you're interested in, what its orbital should look like. Okay, so much for helium. How about a much more interesting atom, carbon? Now, the 1s electron lives very near the nucleus, right? So the other electrons aren't between the 1s orbital and the nucleus. So it sees pretty much the whole nucleus, except for the screening by the other 1s electron. So you see it has an effective Z of 5.67, right? Almost the same reduction as in the case of helium, where the other 1s electron is shielding the electron you're interested in. But when you get out to Z effective for the n equals 2 orbital, 2s or 2p, there's a very great reduction in the effective Z. Why is that so? Henry? Because the two core electrons really do block the nucleus completely. They are on the nucleus from the point of view of the other electrons. Right, so you immediately cut off 2 and go down to 4, and then you get a little bit more from screening of the other electrons, of the other n equals 2 electrons. So 3.22 for the 2s electron and 3.14 for the 2p electrons. Now, why aren't they the same value? Why don't you get the same screening, the same Z effective for 2s and 2p? Jordan? Pardon me?
If you are looking at 2p, then you're going to already remove 2s, and the ionization energy for 2p is going to be higher.
But the same would be true of 2s. No, what you do is you look at all the other electrons and let them screen the nucleus, and you're interested in one. If the one you're interested in is 2s, the other 5 electrons are there. Right? If you're interested in 2p, the other 5 electrons are there. But why don't they see the same effective? Sonny? Now, if you lived closer to the nucleus, you wouldn't be as much screened, right? Is that what you see, that the 2p is less screened than 2s, Sonny? It's vice versa. It looks like the s lives closer to the nucleus on average than the p does, right? So the 2s is slightly less screened than 2p. Now, does that make sense? Well, there's the 2s orbital and its radial, so-called radial distribution function, that r squared weighting thing. So that's where the 2s electron lives. And here's where the 2p electron lives, right? Now, here's where the 1s electron lives. Okay? Now, there's this bit here of the 1s that clearly is down close to the nucleus and is not being very effectively screened by these or by these, if you're thinking about the 2s, right? But on the other hand, this lump is closer to the nucleus than this lump is. So it's sort of a delicate thing. But anyhow, the way they did the calculation, it turned out that 2s is slightly less screened. It's on average, whatever average means, closer to the nucleus than 2p for purposes at least of screening. Good. So now, how about if we go to sodium? Now you see again that the core electrons are hardly screened at all, right? Instead of 11, it's 10.63. All these are reduced by about the same amount, 0.3 or 0.4, right? It's just the screening by the other 1s, right? But then the 2s, 2p, and notice 3s, which is way out there, has all the 2s's and 2p's and 1s inside it mostly, right? So it sees just 2.5, very little charge, the last electron that came in. And now what do you notice that's interesting? The purposes of what we've been saying. Sonny? It's switched. It's vice versa. Right? So obviously that's a pretty subtle question. But notice that this is the reason that 2s and 2p or 3s and 3p, that the different orbital angular momentums, L quantum number, have different energies. It's because of repulsion by the other electrons. If you only had one electron, remember, the energy depends only on what n is. It doesn't depend on L or m. Okay, so anyhow, it's a subtle question, but this is a way of doing it, but it's a pretty crude way of doing it. Right? So it's better than nothing, a lot better than nothing, but it's not going to get you there. Okay, now a better way is what's called self-consistent field. And this is the approach that Clemente and Raimondi did with their IBM 7090 computer in 1963 to see what the best values of Z effective would be. So this is a better approach. Okay, self-consistent field. Okay, so this is a recipe. First, you find or guess approximate orbitals for every electron. For example, you could use Z effective to get hydrogen-like orbitals for all the electrons in the problem you're interested in. Say an atom, but you can do the same thing for a molecule. Okay, so you find your set of electrons, the orbitals, as if orbitals were real. Okay. Then you calculate the potential energy. Remember, what you're given in a quantum mechanics problem is the mass of your electron, that's easy, and the potential energy that it feels at different positions. Right? If you know that, then you can find the wave function. Okay. So the potential that you're going to use now, the potential energy, is not just the potential energy of the nucleus, but both the attraction from the nucleus and also the repulsion from all the other electrons while you're working on just one electron, the repulsion from all the others. But the other electrons are not going to be treated as being at the nucleus. They're going to be in probability clouds. So there's a certain amount of the other electron here, a certain amount here, a certain amount here, a certain amount here. And here's your electron you're interested in, and its potential you're going to calculate by the potential energy from the nucleus, plus this little bit of electron density, plus this one, plus this one, plus this one, for all the other electrons. So it, numerically, it's a very intensive thing to do, to have to calculate all these things. And that's why these guys who were at IBM in the days when IBM were the only people who had the computers that could do it, why they did it. So you have fixed clouds of all the other electrons and point nucleus or nuclei, right? And then you have the potential for your one electron, and then you can find its wave function. Now, this is going to be a much better wave function than the one where you pretended that the other nuclei were just reducing the nuclear charge, that everything was just at one point. So it's going to be much better. Can you see what you would do next? What the next step is going to be? So you have crummy first approximation orbitals for all the other electrons. Say there's seven electrons. So you have crummy functions for seven of them, but a good one for six of them, but a good one for the seventh. Henry? Rotate. What do you mean rotate? Now you do one of the other electrons using what you found for this one electron. Everybody got the idea? So now you have bad functions for five, a good function for a sixth, and you're going to use those to calculate the potential energy for the seventh. And now it's the result you get for that is going to even be better than the one you got for the first one you calculated. Okay, so we use this new potential to calculate an improved orbital for, And then we repeat steps 2 and 3 to prove the orbital for another electron, the sixth electron. Now what do? Do it for the fifth, fourth, third, second, first, And now we've got them all improved. Do we quit?
No.
What do we do now? Renchi, do you have an idea what to do now? Now we've got much improved values for all seven electrons, right? Much improved functions for orbitals for all seven electrons. But the seventh isn't so good, right? Because that was the first one we got. But the first one is going to be pretty good because all the other electrons had already been improved. So what do we do now? Yeah, redo the seventh. And then the sixth, the fifth, the fourth, right? So we just keep cycling through. Right, so this is a thing that you can easily program a computer do, but it's very tedious to do it by hand. Right? Okay, what's the problem? Yeah. When are you going to stop? Okay, so the first correction you make is very big to all these, right? The second correction is going to be smaller, and then the next one is going to be smaller, and then really teeny. So what do? You wait until it stops changing within whatever limits you set. And at that point, the field caused by all these electrons is said to be what? Self-consistent, right? It's not changing anymore. It's consistent with itself. Okay, so you cycle back to improve the first, et cetera, et cetera, and you quit when the orbital stops changing. Okay? It's still wrong. Because real electrons aren't fixed clouds, right? As one electron moves from position to position, the other ones change their positions because they move out of the way. Now, what does that fact mean about the energy that you calculate using self-consistent field? Are you going to calculate, Caitlin? It's going to be too high because the electrons are smarter than you are. Right? They can stay out of each other's way where your calculation doesn't let them dynamically stay out of each other's way. It holds them in fixed clouds while you calculate your one electron. Okay? Okay, so the true energy is going to be less than the self-consistent field energy. In other words, there's going to be an error when you do self-consistent field calculations. Now, what do you do about this error? All right. One approach would be to say to everybody, I'm sorry, I did the best I can, but I made an error. Do you think that's what people say? No. This is what they do. Right? They sweep it under the rug. They sweep it under the rug by giving the rug a fancy name that's going to keep people from asking what the rug is. Okay? So what they do is they conceal this residual error after they've done a fully self-consistent field calculation to what's called, this is the name of two people, Hartree-Fock limit. The Hartree-Fock limit is when things stop changing. Right? So you've gotten as good as you can do with self-consistent field. But you give it a fancy name. You call it correlation energy. Right? There's correlation energy. It's not like gravitational energy or Coulombic energy, right? It's an error that you make when you do self-consistent field, but you call it correlation energy, and then people will say, wow, he knows what correlation energy is. I never heard of that. Okay? But that's what correlation energy is. Now, in order to know what correlation energy is, you have to know, do your self-consistent field calculation, get what that energy is, and then take the difference between that and what's real. That's the error. How do you know what's real? You can do an experiment, or you can do a really good calculation, better than self-consistent field. So you can use experiment, or some kind of whopping calculation, more complicated than self-consistent field. For example, there's a thing called configuration interaction that we won't talk about at all, right? But it's a fancier way of calculating, much more complicated. And more recently, there's a technique been invented called density functional theory, for which people got the Nobel Prize, I don't know, about 10 years ago or something like that. So there are fancier ways of getting of avoiding this problem, of taking the correlation. See why it's called correlation energy? Because it comes from the fact that as this electron moves, this also moves in conjunction with the first to stay away from it. Sagar? Are they what? Yeah, the total energy. Right. But you get the total energy, by adding up the energies of all the electrons. Right? Each electron has some energy. Add them all up, you get the total energy.
For the atom.
For the atom or molecule. A set of nuclei, and you know, it also includes electron energy due to nuclear repulsion and so on. It's the whole energy. But you know, that part is easy because the nuclei stay pretty much fixed. Their waves are very concentrated, right? So you can treat them as points, okay. It's the electrons you have trouble with because they're spread out by their kinetic energy. Okay, so, but here's a promising solution. If we're really lucky, we might be able to neglect this error. It might not make any difference. Now, how could it possibly not make a difference? Well, we need to know how big it is. Okay, so here's a log scale of energy in kilocalories per mole. It's an enormous scale, right, up to 10 to the 8th kilocalories per mole. So should we care about the energy that would come in orbital theory? Okay, that is to say about correlation energy. Well, let's think about the source of energies when particles come together and make something. First, the nuclei come together, protons and neutrons, and they give off a lot of energy. And if you look at the weight, the mass of a nucleus and the mass of the particles it came from, you find that there's a little loss in mass on assembling a nucleus, a certain amount of 0.1 atomic mass units is lost in assembling a carbon nucleus. And if you use E equals mc squared to find out what that mass is equal to, you find out it's an energy of 2 times 10 to the 9th kilocalories per mole. So an enormous amount of energy. I mean, that's why you have atomic bombs and nuclear power plants and so on. There's a lot of energy there. Okay. So, but that gives us a C plus 6 nucleus. That's the big game. Okay, then you can add 2 electrons to that, the core, the 1s electrons, and that you see is down in energy. The amount of energy you get from that is 5 orders of magnitude less than assembling the nucleus. So if you made any error in calculating the energy for putting the nucleus together, I mean a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage error, it would be much bigger than the energy of electrons going on to a nucleus. Right, that's the big game, is putting the nucleus together. That makes physicists proud. Okay, now then you put 4 more valence electrons onto the carbon atom, and that's another order of magnitude down. 1/10 from those 4 electrons, you get as much energy, 1/10 as much energy as you did from the first 2. Okay, and then you take carbon atoms and put them together, sharing their electrons to make bonds. Okay. So we make bonds. But it takes 2 to tango here, right? There are 2 carbon atoms to make the bond. So you should give half the energy to each carbon atom, right? So the amount of energy you get from making 4 bonds would be, per carbon atom, is 1/2 of making 4 single bonds, right? Now, so that a single bond is about 100 kilocalories per mole. So 2 would be about 2 times 10 squared. So another order of magnitude down, the making of bonds after you already have the atom, at least in the case of a carbon atom. Okay, and then there are energies that don't involve forming bonds, shared pair bonds, things called non-bonded interactions or contacts between things that hold liquids together, for example, or van der Waals forces. So these non-bonded contacts are another order of magnitude smaller, so 1 to 20 kilocalories per mole, although they can get smaller and smaller, and the weakest of all is between 2 helium atoms. Right? It's been found experimentally that 2 helium atoms form a bond. Not a shared pair bond, but they're lower in energy when they're together than when they're apart. But they're not much lower in energy than when they're together and they're apart. In fact, the bond distance is 52 angstroms, the minimum energy for 2 heliums. What is it for two carbons? 1.5, right? So the heliums at their minimum energy are way far apart, 50 angstroms apart. And the amount of energy is 2 times 10 to the minus 6th kilocalories per mole instead of 100 kilocalories per mole. So that's the weakest that's been measured that I know of. Okay, so now all these things down here are due to Coulomb potential, as we've been talking about. Okay, the top one is this nuclear force, which is a completely different thing. Okay, so a 0.001% change in nuclear energy or error in calculating it would overwhelm anything that has to do with Coulomb. okay? Fortunately for chemists, right, it never changes. Right? Once you have a nucleus, you can do all the chemistry you want, and it, the energy within the nucleus doesn't change at all. Right? So, that means even though it's really important in the overall scheme of things, we can neglect it. Because when you go from one set of nuclei to from a set of atoms to another arrangement of the same atoms, when you do a reaction, you can just subtract out the nuclear energy because it's the same on both sides, so you don't care. Now, do you see why I went into this? It's because it might be the same with correlation energy. Now, how big is correlation energy? These errors we make. Well, it turns out that correlation energy is as big as a bond. Right? The error you make in neglecting the correlation of the electron is as strong as a bond. That sounds, I mean, if it were down here someplace, you wouldn't care about it. Right? But it's up at the same energy level that we're interested in. So this sounds like trouble unless, what? Unless it doesn't change when you do a reaction. If you make the same error on this side of the equation as you do on this, then it's like the nuclear energy. You can just forget it. Okay, so that would be fortunate. So the correlation energy is about as big as a bond. And changes in the correlation energy from when you do a reaction, changes can be about 10 to 15% as big. Right? So, what do we conclude from that? That means that orbital theory, which makes this error of correlation energy, is fine if we want just qualitative answers. Right? If we can tolerate 10% of a bond energy error, then it's okay. So we can understand what bonds are by using orbitals, right? But if we want really precise values, then we're going to have to get them someplace else, right? This stuff here actually is due to correlation, right? Non-bonded attractions between things, what holds most biological molecules together once you already have the bonds, all that stuff actually is correlation. Right? Van der Waals forces are correlation energy. Right? You don't calculate them when you do SCF calculations. Right? So it's really important for understanding things. But for qualitative purposes of understanding chemical bonds, if we can tolerate a 10% error, which for qualitative purposes we can, then fine. But if we want to get really accurate results, we have to do either experiment or a calculation that's more believable than self-consistent field. Derek?
So correlation energy is just the energy due to the movement of electrons?
Yeah, it's how much electrons are able to lower their energy compared to SCF by keeping out of each other's way. Right? But obviously that's a more complicated calculation than assuming the other electrons are fixed.
So does that occur more often when there's Van der Waals forces? Like, is that what...
Yeah, I mean, there are always Van der Waals forces. I mean, you might say between different groups on the same molecule, there are Van der Waals forces, which come from the correlation of the electrons in these two parts. Right? So electron correlation is this attraction that comes not from sharing electrons, normal bonds, but by electrons keeping out of each other's way. So orbitals can't be true. We know that because they repel one another if you have more than one electron. Okay, but we'll still use them to understand bonding and structure and energy and reactivity. It'll be our main tool, right? But we put a footnote here because what we're aiming to do is understand, not to do things quantitatively. So we have to resort to experiment or to fancy calculations if we want precise numbers. Okay, now if we use orbitals, how do we get total electron density, which we could compare with X-ray? Well, we find out what the density of electron 1 is by squaring its wave function, the density of electron 2, and add them together, right? And you get then the total density. Now, the total density is a function of position. What's the total density here? You take psi 1, find out what its value is there, square it. Take psi 2, a p orbital maybe, something different. Find its value at the same point. Square that. Add the two together. That's the total electron density at that point. So that's a very straightforward recipe. But notice it's a sum, not a product. Sometimes we're multiplying things and sometimes we're adding them. Here we're obviously adding to get the total density because we're not interested in the joint probability. We're not asking the question, what's the probability that electron 1 will be here at a given time and electron 2 will be exactly the same place at exactly the same time? That's a question of joint probability. Can you guess what it would be?
Zero.
Why? Because they repel one another. That's the correlation. They keep away from each other. Sharif?
Shouldn't you subtract the product from the sum?
No. You know you'll be making an error, this correlation error.
Right.
But it won't be subtracting the product from the sum to correct for it. It's a much more complicated thing than that. Okay. And we talked about this actually in the review session, and you had it in the problem set, about how lumpy a nitrogen atom would be if it had three 2p electrons. Okay? That we'd square the density from each of them, and in adding them together then, we get it's x squared plus y squared plus z squared, which is r squared, so it doesn't depend on any angle, so it's spherical. It doesn't look lumpy as it did in a particular textbook here. It looks spherical, the total electron density. So that's nice. We can do that. It's not that. Okay, or in this case, we had a puzzle. What did the cross-section of the carbon-nitrogen triple bond look like, which was made out of px and py orbitals on the c and the n atom? But in the cross-section, if what we're adding is 2px squared plus 2py squared, that depends on x squared plus y squared, which doesn't, if this is x and this is y, the value of x squared plus y squared is r squared. It's the same for all positions around a circle. So it's circularly symmetric or cylindrically symmetric or axially symmetric. So that's why it looks that way in reality. Okay, so we've done pretty well with atoms. We looked at three-dimensional reality for one-electron atoms. We looked at hybridization, if you put an extra field on or something, how it might change. We've looked at orbitals for many electron atoms and seen that it's wrong, but we've seen how to recover by using, for example, SCF and then sweeping the correlation under the rug, hoping that for qualitative purposes it cancels out. Okay, now we want to go on to molecules, obviously, because we're not just physicists. Okay, so the first thing, as I said, we want to do is the primary thing we want to do is to understand bonds in terms of what we'll call pairwise LCAOMOs. I'll explain what that means. But the pairwise aspect, you can understand. You bring two atoms together, two orbitals interact and make a bond. So pairwise. Okay, that's the main thing we're going to use to understand bonds. But and the tools we'll use are what's called overlap and energy match, and we'll understand that when the time comes. But first I want to give you in the rest of the lecture today an aside on understanding computer-generated molecular orbitals. We're the ones who look at these pairs and try to understand in terms of those. That's not what a computer does. A computer finds molecular orbitals that go over the whole molecule. So if you do a molecular orbital calculation, you get a result that looks not like a bond, a bond, a bond. It looks weird. And I want you to understand what's involved there. And it's pretty neat. We'll call it plum pudding molecular orbitals, or the united atom limit. Now, let's first think about what makes atomic orbitals look the way they do, and then we'll see how the same principle applies to molecular orbitals. So what gives atomic orbitals their shape? Okay, one thing is kinetic energy, the Schrödinger equation. It creates nodes and waves of a certain shape. For example, it makes this node in a 2s orbital, or it makes these nodes in a 4d orbital. Right? So you have these nodal patterns that come just from kinetic energy. And notice, the idea of kinetic energy shouldn't depend on whether you're using atoms or molecules. Right? If kinetic energy is kinetic energy. Okay, so that principle should be the same for molecular as it is for atomic orbitals. What's going to be different is the thing that has to do with potential energy. We've already seen how potential energy scales are. If you double the nuclear charge, the orbital gets half as big. Right, we've seen that. So these same principles must apply in molecular orbitals. The kinetic energy is going to make nodal patterns, no nodes, one node, two nodes, three nodes, and so on, and different patterns when you have many nodes, different combinations of different kinds of nodes. Right? And then there's going to be the nuclear charges, which instead of just being one nucleus, are now going to be several nuclei that are going to distort these shapes we get from kinetic energy. So let's see how that works out. Now, you know that all the stories that appear in many cultures about the different blind men looking at an elephant, and one says it looks like a rope, and another one says it looks like I don't know what, but different kinds of stuff. Okay, so they see different things because of the way they look at it or feel it. Okay, now we can do the same thing with H2. Here's real H2. That's the total electron density plotted out in contours. But which contour do we want to look at? Okay? Now, if you look at a really high electron density contour, what you see is atoms that look, for all you can tell, like normal atoms. Where have you seen this? You look at a molecule and all you see is atoms. Have you ever seen that? Yes, honey? Not difference density. If you look at total electron density, remember potassium penicillin? When you look at that map, it was just a bunch of atoms. So if you look at high electron density, it looks just like a set of normal atoms. Then you would say a molecule is just a set of atoms. Okay, if you look at that contour. But suppose you go to a lower energy density like this, a lower electron density like this, and now you see that they're a little bit distorted. How do you do that experimentally? See that they're not just atoms. That's what you said. You do a difference density, right? And we've seen that. And now you say the molecule is made from a set of atoms, but pairs of atoms have interacted to build up a 20th of a Lewis in between the nuclei. Okay? But if you look at the far out low electron density contours, then at first glance it just looks like an atom, a whole molecule, I mean a whole DNA molecule. If you looked at it from a meter away, would look like at really low density electron density, it looks like a sphere. Right? It looks just like an atom. Okay, so let's take that view, the molecule as one atom. Let's take that perspective and see what we can see. Although it's not a normal atom, because if you look at the nucleus, what's happened is it has been distorted by the nucleus breaking into two nuclei in the case of H2, or a lot of nuclei in the case of DNA. So we want to understand this distortion and what a computer is going to see when it looks at molecular orbitals. So what we see then is nuclei embedded in a cloud of electrons. The electrons themselves are a cloud that's been dispersed and given nodes because of Schrödinger's equation, because of kinetic energy, the same thing we saw in an atom. Okay, so that's the point of view we're going to take. But the interesting thing about it is what that means is that this is a plum pudding. The plums are the nuclei put in a diffuse electric negative charge cloud. Remember what Thompson said about the atom? He said it was little corpuscles of negative electron density, negative electrons, these corpuscles, put in a positive cloud. The only thing he had wrong was the charge for purpose of describing molecules. What a molecule is a bunch of nuclei embedded in something that's given shape by all these nodal patterns that atoms have. So it's the plum pudding backwards. And it's worth, although it's not practical for purposes of getting answers. When you want to solve an organic chemistry problem, you think about bonds, and that's what we're going to do. But it's worth first looking at this to see the analogy with atoms, I think. Okay, so the question is, how do the plums distort hydrogen-like orbitals, these kinetic energy puddings? Incidentally, that's plum pudding. It's like fruitcake. Okay, so let's compare methane and ammonia as calculated with a pretty good self-consistent field program on my laptop with something that has the same number of protons and the same number of electrons but is a single atom. In order to understand these computer-generated orbitals visually, Okay, so if we drew Lewis structures, we'd see four pairs of valence electrons for carbon and for methane and four pairs of valence electrons for nitrogen. But the difference between ammonia and carbon is the top proton in carbon has gone into the nucleus to convert carbon into nitrogen. Okay? So how does this change things when you move the nuclei around? Or we could say that the whole set of them are like the neon atom, which has all the nuclei, all the protons in the nucleus. And we pull three protons out of the nucleus and we have ammonia. Pull four protons out of the nucleus, you have methane. But you'll distort the atomic orbitals when you move these around, and we want to understand that. Okay, so there's what a 1s neon looks like. And there's the 1s orbital, this net here, the red net on methane, and drawn at the contour level, 0.001 electrons per cubic angstrom. And here's the same thing for ammonia. Right? Now, those are the core orbitals, the 1s. Right, they're very tightly held around the central nucleus where most of the protons are, and fundamentally they're boring. Right, they're just spheres down near the nucleus. So we want to understand bonding, so we'll forget those. We'll focus on the valence orbitals. Okay, now there are 8 valence electrons, or 4 occupied molecular orbitals, each with a pair in methane, and they look like that in energy. There's one lowest one, and then 3 higher ones. What does that remind you of? 1 and then 3 in the energy. No. Sinead, you had an idea? It reminds you of something? No, you were just brushing your hair. Okay. Mike?
Energy conservation and then force square and Hooke's law of potential?
No, it's not what it reminds me of. Caitlin?
SOP orbitals?
You know what it reminds me of? An S and 3P orbitals. Right? In ammonia, it's a little different. So it's 3 degenerate molecular orbitals, like the 3 2p orbitals, right? And over here, it's a little bit different because you're lacking one of those protons. So you have 1 and then 2 and then 1. So let's look first at the lowest sort of unhappy face orbitals here in the two cases, okay? Okay, so there's what it looks like in... This is the 2s orbital. That's what it looks like in neon. And here's what it looks like in methane, and there's what it looks like in ammonia. Does it make sense to you that it would look like that? How would you interpret that? What makes the difference between the 2s of the atom and the 2s of the molecule? Kathy, you got an idea? Is the 2s the 2s of the atom is spherical? Is the 2s of methane spherical? Does it surprise you that it's not spherical? What caused it to be not spherical? The protons pulled the sphere in the direction they went, right? They're attracting electrons, so they distort it. Why does it look different in ammonia and in... How do you go from methane to ammonia? What happens to go from one to the next? Derek? The top proton goes into the nucleus and pulls the electron cloud with it. See what I mean? So those are 2s atomic orbitals that have been distorted by moving the protons around. Okay, and in fact you can see they're 2s because although the algorithm that draws these nets isn't designed to draw such very small things because it makes straight line segments. But you can see the node here, the inner part here, right, that has the opposite sign, just like in a 2s orbital. So those are 2s orbitals of molecules. Okay, now let's... And they have this spherical node. Okay, now, how about those? Right, those are 2px orbitals. Right? But they've been distorted a little bit by the way the protons have moved out of the nucleus. Or how about this one? Well, we're looking the wrong direction along the y-axis to see what's really going on, so we need to rotate it. So let's rotate it by 90 degrees, and then it looks like that. So those are two PY orbitals, but the top has been spread out by moving two protons out there. Everybody see that? Or let's look at the 2PZ orbital. Right? Now, what's the difference between this is spread out on the bottom because of these two protons. This is spread out on the bottom because of these two. And that one is pulled up to the top a little bit by a proton coming up. But if you put the proton back in the nucleus, it looks like that. And that one on the right is the unshared pair. What we would call the unshared pair of the nitrogen. Right? Okay. But there are other orbitals. If you mix a certain number of orbitals, atomic orbitals, you get out of it the same number of molecular orbitals. Right? So if we're mixing carbon's valence orbitals, there are four of those, 2s and 3 2p's, with four hydrogen orbitals, four 1s orbitals, we should get 8 molecular orbitals out of that. We've seen only 4 of them here, plus the core, the 1s. Right? So there must be 4 more that don't have electrons in them. Let's look at those. Okay, they're the energy patterns. Look first at the one that's alone. Right? And you can see what that is. It's a 3s orbital. Right? You can see one node here easily, and there's another small one down inside. And the same thing over there where you can't really see it unless we turn the... That's the lowest unoccupied molecular orbital of ammonia. And if we turn it to look from the bottom, you can see that spherical or distorted spherical node. And the same thing for methane, which is the highest unoccupied molecular orbital in methane, something that you're almost never interested in. Okay, here's the 3dx squared minus y squared, which you don't notice so well in this perspective, but if you rotate the thing, you can see easily what it is. It's that cross where two protons pulled the sides up. Got it? Okay, or you can look at this one, right, which if you rotate it up, is again a cross with protons pulling out the top lobes. Or if you look at this one, that's that 3dz squared where the inner tube that goes around the middle has been pulled down by the three hydrogens coming down. Okay, there it is looked at from the bottom. Okay, now you can apply the same thing to any molecule. You could do it with DNA. It has those atomic orbitals distorted, but it's much more distortion about such a long molecule. But anyhow, let's look at ethane and methanol. Hey, we got a minute here to do it. Okay, 7 pairs of valence electrons. Now, compare those to argon, which has 7 pairs of electrons. Okay, so we're only not looking at the core orbitals here. Actually, here's a pedantic note. If you have two heavy atoms, like we have two carbons in the case of ethane, now there are two boring core orbitals, not just one. So for purposes of making these analogies, it's better to consider just the valence orbitals. And so I won't read the rest of that. You can read it when you want to. But there you see is a 2s orbital that's been distorted by pulling the carbons apart and then pulling a hydrogen out of each of them. And to get a different perspective, we could rotate by 90 degrees around that axis to see a similar thing, but rotated 90 degrees. It'll be on subsequent orbitals that'll be better, more informative. Okay, now here's if you take one of those protons, or two of those protons on the top carbon and put them back into the nucleus, so we have an oxygen on top. Now, it looks like that, which is again distorted, but it's pulled up by the fact that there are more protons in this nucleus than this one, and out to the right by the one hydrogen from being a sphere. And you can see it in right angles there as well. Or here's the 2PZ. Again, makes perfect sense. Okay, or 2PX, right? Sometimes you see it better in this view and sometimes in that view, depending on which one you're talking about. Here you can see the right to left PX-ness of it, the vertical node. Okay, or the 2PY, which now you see on the right. Or the 3S, see the spherical node? The extra spherical node. The first node is real close to the nuclei. You don't see it. It's under the spheres. And in fact, it's in two parts, a core of one and a core of the other. But the valence orbitals are these atomic orbitals, right? Or there's the 3D XZ, very clear. Or the 3D YZ, which you see on the right. Or the 3D Z squared, where now that inner tube around the middle is pulled first up, then down, then up, then down, then up, then down. It goes like this around the edge. Right? But it's the 3D Z squared orbital. Okay, or the 3PZ, which has a spherical node as well as the P, the horizontal plane of a P orbital, but a spherical node as well. So you see it here, here's the sphere that is a node. Here's the sphere that is a node right here. Although it's very distorted because of where the protons are. Or here's the 3PY, same deal. Or 3PX. Or the 3DXY, or the 3DX squared minus Y squared, or the 4F orbital.